You're listening to Beyond 1894, a podcast dedicated to updating you on research, innovation, and campus life happening at Louisiana Tech University.
Good afternoon and welcome to Skate Country. My name is Brian. I'll be your floor guard and DJ for this session. These rules are very important. Please pay attention. They will be enforced all session long. Rule number one, there is no fast skating allowed at any time. If you're passing up more skaters than are passing you, you're skating too fast and you must slow down. Rule number two, no tag, trains, chains, or other horseplay is allowed at any time. Skaters doing so will be asked to leave the skating floor. I could do all 10, but I'm not going to.
So, hey, y'all, and welcome to Beyond 1894. I'm Tanya Oakes-Smith, Executive Director of University Communications, and I'm here today with Dr. Brian Zygmunt, who is our Associate Dean in the College of Liberal Arts. And we've got a lot of things to talk to Dr. Zygmunt, Brian, as I call him, about today. One of those things is actually what his former job was that he shared a little bit with y'all in the introduction to this podcast.
Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, I had the good pleasure of being a DJ at a roller skating rink for 5.5 years. And in many ways, it was a marvelous way of learning to be an extrovert when I'm more of an introvert by nature.
Well, that's I can't imagine you being an introvert. Mostly because you seem so extroverted. But I think that that's funny that you actually, the minute the mics went hot, you were jumping on and giving us an example of the things that you used to do. But tell us now, and thanks for being with us today, by the way. Tell us what you teach art history, correct?
I do.
Okay. And one of the things that you're especially invested in is in our study abroad program, Tech France, this next summer in 2022. So tell us a little bit about this.
Well, very much so. As an art history major, I always wanted to study abroad when I was an undergraduate student. And honestly, the $5 an hour I made skating in a circle at Skate Country East made that very difficult to fund. But then moving forward in graduate school, I was able to save up enough one summer to go to Paris for about 6 weeks. And it really just changed my life, and not just for me as an art historian, but me as someone who lived most of my life, most of my cognitive life in the same place. I began to appreciate that people didn't all look or think or believe the same things that I did, and it really did open up my world in a lot of really fascinating ways. And even then, and this would have been in the summer of 2000, I had aspirations to be an art history professor. And I always hoped that doing that work would allow me the opportunity to help introduce students to that same kind of experience. And I'm delighted that it remains part of my job here, even though I serve as the associate dean.
So where are students going? And you have a bounteous group of students, right, going this next year?
I do. So at the end of my first year here, I took 6 noble students to Toulouse, France, where they stayed a month. And the following summer in 19, I took 15 brave souls to Italy, where we spent 4 weeks in Rome, Siena, and Florence. And for the summer of 22, I've got, count them, 40 students who have already signed up to go to Paris. And we'll focus in Paris, but we'll do some day trips beyond that. But I have 40 students, which is a lot.
So tell us what the study abroad experience involves. I would assume that, especially in Paris, it means you go to the Louvre, right?
Yes, day one. Day one.
Okay.
You know, as I think study abroad can take a lot of different forms. What I try to do is provide a kind of safety net and structure that allows students both to hang out with me enough and then explore life on their own. So you've asked about the Louvre, so I'll sort of tell you. You know, we fly on a Tuesday, we get on a Wednesday. On Thursday morning at 9 o'clock, I meet them at the Louvre. And we're going to hang out at the Louvre from 9 until 1 o'clock. I'm going to yodel about all kinds of paintings and sculptures. And at 1 o'clock, their day with me is over. I give them a high five, and I break them into groups, and I ask them to go find an adventure. The next morning, I will see you at Notre Dame at 9 o'clock, where we'll repeat that same kind of thing. And because we have the healthy group that we do, people are going to meet their new, their 39 new best friends, and have a lot of company and collegiality as they march around the cities, the city of Paris.
So you have, I'm assuming, students of all different majors, and that that adds to the educational experience, right, for everybody.
I'm delighted. Let me tell you, it's from every college on campus and from more majors than I can count. I mean, I have mechanical engineering, chemical engineering, biomedical engineering, civil engineering. I've got music, art, architecture, interior design, communication, finance, physics. There's a major I've never even heard of before, and I can't even remember what it is now. He's coming too. And so, I mean, because really, like study abroad is not just merely about like art and architecture or croissants. It really is about like what it means to be human. I mean, you're going to come, as I've told them, you're going to come back a different person. And this is equally beneficial to the art major as it is to the engineer.
So one of the things in this next year, in 2023, you will be going to Italy, right? Is that correct?
So I'll give you a confession. When I took students to Toulouse, at the end of that month, I came back, and it's exhausting. I mean, I spend 30 days counting heads. I came back to Happy Rustin, and I said to my wife, I'm never going to do that again. And then a week later, I'm planning the next trip. And the same thing happened at the end of Italy. I'm like, I'm never going to do that again. You know, and by September, I'm like, okay, let's go. I never thought I'd get to 40 students, and I never thought I would have 15 people who wanted to go, and I just didn't have space for them. So I began collecting those names and said, I'll let you know what we can figure out. Would you be interested in going back to, I don't know, Italy instead the next summer? And they all enthusiastically said, yes, Italy sounds fine. And so I've begun working in whatever way I can with another trip already in the hopper on Italy for 2023.
Okay, that's exciting. And it's exciting for so many students to be able to take advantage of that. Because I know I've heard about students who do study abroad programs and they've never gotten on a plane before. And this is just, it makes their life so much bigger and richer, right?
It does. I mean, and for me, you know, over the course of a quarter, students grow and they learn, and it's incremental, and you often don't see it. But in the course of a month, you can see every day, and, you know, I'll give you just sort of an example, but this would go for any of the trips I've been a part of. You know, I've had students who've never been on an airplane before. I've had students who don't know how to buy a railroad ticket. And I've had students who needed me incessantly for everything for the first week. And by the fourth week of it, it's like I don't even need to be there. I've been completely replaced, and I'm now a useless middle-aged hanger-oner because everything they thought they needed me for, they've learned how to do it themselves. And although it's, you know, kind of heartbreaking to realize that you've now been, you know, you're now unneeded, there's a certain joy in watching the learning and growth that happens so quickly.
So speaking of Italy, one of the things that you tweet about and talk about on social media is your passion for Dante and reading Dante. And you read Dante in the quad almost every day.
I do.
And so tell me, how did this come to be? And how does this work in with your art history and, you know, this make it make sense, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I'm not sure I can make it make sense, but I will tell you that, like, I came to Dante as a freshman in college when I took a humanities course, and only read probably bits and pieces of the Inferno, but then bought it, you know, in the beginning of my book buying problem, which would have been early in graduate school, and kind of read it in sort of a pivotal moment in my life, and it provided me with, like, hope and belief and faith and things. And then when I was a PhD student, a new translation came out. And because I was working at a Barnes & Noble for, you know, book money, essentially, I bought this new translation. And it really sort of got me into it. But I realized that the translation I was reading was different in many ways than the first one I had read. And so I just began collecting translations of Dante. And I've always thought poetry made good, light reading because they're often bracketed in small chunks. It's not like a big chapter. You could read a canto of Dante and it would take you 10 minutes. And so my life, my work life is often rather full, but I like to think that I should be able to find every day 10 minutes to read a bit of Dante. And so what I try to do is grab whatever translation I'm working on, and right now it's the Longfellow translation, and I go out and sit in front of Misty, as I call her, and I read a canto of Dante, and maybe two if I'm sneaky, and then kind of re-energized and thankful for some moments of peace in front of a fountain, if not like peace, because there's some parts of Dante are not peaceful, I return to my office and continue to fight the good fight.
So speaking of parts that aren't peaceful, this week is Halloween week, right?
Indeed.
So, and you know, for those of us who are not familiar with Dante, explain the concept of Dante's trilogy, I guess.
Sure. So, I mean, there's a lot of marvelous things one could say about Dante, but about the Divine Comedy. But it begins with him essentially taking a field trip to hell with his, I don't know, muse, his sort of poetic muse, which is Virgil. And so Virgil takes him on a field trip down through hell, where Dante comes to meet all of the sinners who have maybe done less than good things throughout their lives. And in a lot of ways, it is a history lesson. It's a religious lesson. It's a lesson in economics and in social structures. And it very much says a lot about what all of those things were during Dante's own lifetime. And so before I came here at my previous institution, I was teaching a class on Renaissance art, and we read Dante because art history is really about the intersection of art and history and politics and religion and economics into something somebody makes. And the Divine Comedy is about that same kind of thing. And so if you want to learn about the late medieval mindset on sin, Dante will tell you. If you want to learn about religion, it's there. If you want to learn about the political struggle in Florence and Siena, you can find it. And so I often can find, like I can find ways to bring Indiana Jones into an art historical lecture, so too can I find a way to bring Dante.
So speaking of, you know, there are some parts in the Inferno in particular that I remember being horrified about. I mean, it, you know, people gnawing on other people's necks and, you know, there. So it is in parts like a horror film.
Indeed.
And the visualization for me of those sections was very, you know, just dramatic, I guess. So tell us about how the art, because there's been a lot of art that kind of surrounds this work. Tell us about that art.
Sure. Well, I mean, very broadly, I mean, long before people could read, they could read visual images. And so if you were to walk around the outside of a medieval church, that church has things to say about sinning. You might not be able to read the words, but you can understand the torture and mayhem that's happening to the sinners. As it pertains to the Inferno or Dante's work more broadly, he has visualized. So Dante's from Florence, and he grew up and was born very close to the baptistry. The baptistry dates from the 11th century. And on the ceiling vault of that is a mosaic that chronicles hell and sin and punishment. And so Dante, we sort of imagine going there as a young lad and looking up at this and it very much informing his construction of what hell might have looked like in the literary sense. And then artists who have followed him have very much worked in a very similar kind of vein. And so one of the most popular artistic motifs in the early and even through the later Renaissance are Last Judgment scenes, where you'll have a gigantic Christ sitting in the middle, sort of judging the living and the dead, and the bad people are on the left side of Christ, the good people on the right-hand side are ascending, and the bad things that are happening to the people on the bad side of Christ would definitely be motivation for the sinners amongst us to perhaps lead a more holy, sanctified life.
So, because this is Halloween week, I'm going to ask you what the five scariest pieces of art are in your frame.
This is interesting. So I write on early American portraiture, so I'll give you one that is very off the board. But in 1671 through 74, an anonymous artist who we call the Freak Painter painted a portrait of John Freak, and then a double portrait of Mary and Elizabeth Freak. And it's Freak, F-R-E-A-K-E. And in a non-traditional way, those are pretty scary, because that kid looks like it's like two-thirds into the grave, I suspect. Let me think about scary. You know, one of the really great paintings in the Sistine Chapel is Michelangelo's Last Judgment. There's some pretty scary things happening to dead people on there, including Michelangelo having painted a self-portrait, like a flayed version of his own body being held by St. Bartholomew. I find that pretty scary. I don't know if I can get to five, but I would tell you in a museum in Spain in the Prado is a painting by Hieronymus Bosch called The Garden of Earthly Delights. It dates from around 1510, and it's a triptych, so it's a three-panel altarpiece. And on the left panel is this sort of Garden of Eden scene. Like, it looks like there's a Jesus and maybe an Adam and an Eve and all kinds of mythological creatures who look like they're all getting along quite well. In the middle panel is this gigantic depiction of like the world gone to hell in a handbasket. It's like all kinds of crazy stuff happening. And when I teach this in class, I often just show a detail and I say, I don't know. Like, I don't know what's up with the big strawberry. I'm not sure what's up with the gigantic bird eating the people. I'm not sure why that person's doing that to that animal. I have no idea. But the third panel is this really dark depiction that people sort of interpret as hell. And as a matter of fact, the copy of Dante I have here, this is a depiction. This is a scene from that painting. They're like all kinds of scary, bad things happening in there. There's like a person who's been strung up like a guitar. There's alligators eating nuns. There's people playing vices. There's rabbits wearing witches' cauldrons on their heads. There is what looks to be like the River Styx and the Castle of Dis from Dante's Inferno back there. I want nothing to do with that place. Do you need me to find four?
That's three.
That's three. Do I have to find four and five? Oh, heavens. Do I have to get to five? What can
you
find? No,
you don't have to get to five.
It might come to me, though.
Well, if it comes to you at some other time, because you teach a film class as well.
I have.
And we were talking earlier, and you told me that you didn't really like horror.
It's not that I don't like them. Horror movies seldom scare me. Like, if the goal is to scare people, I'm often not scared because I don't sort of give myself over to the guy with the knife chasing the girl in the tank top. So, like, that doesn't work for me, but I get scared in movies. And so when we chatted this morning, I kept thinking, what are some movies that, like, genuinely terrified me? And I think some of them still do. And they're not, like, horror movies. But, like, Jaws still gets to me. Like, Jaws still does it for me. And I was chatting about this with my sons a couple days ago because they were talking about scuba diving. And I once went scuba diving and I saw a shark. And I was so scared. And I remember when I went up and I said, how big was that shark? He's like, I was like 2 feet tall or 2 feet long. I was like, what, like this? And I thought I was going to die. So like Jaws still works on me. But another movie, and I think like Jaws, I saw it entirely too early in my life, was Rosemary's Baby, which is a Polanski movie, maybe from like, I don't know, 69, 68, 69. And that's about when my mother would have graduated from high school. My mother graduated in 67. So this was like a movie from her early adulthood. So I know she must have seen it. But I saw that when I was a kid, and wow. And even now when I watch that and I know how it ends, it still gets me. But I was thinking, like, the only movie I've ever really seen that truly terrified me, but did for like 5 seconds, was the end of The Blair Witch Project. And I can't tell you anything about the movie because I saw it in the theater. I've seen it once. And all I remember, I don't even know what the ending was. I have no clue. All I remember is I was terrified. But other than that, like, you know, like chainsaw movies or like people with, you know, clubs or whatever, like running, they don't scare me.
Right. I have to tell you, one of the scariest things that I've seen in a movie is the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, or where they opened the Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I know that you're a big Indiana Jones fan, so I thought that we could talk a little bit about
Let's do that.
Okay.
I didn't have talking about Indiana Jones
on your list.
On my podcast bingo list today,
that's
okay. But I'm thrilled.
It's there. Because, you know, being raised in the environment that I was raised in, and I knew the history of the Ark, that nobody is to look at the Ark. Nobody, you know, there is a reason that this happens. It's almost like Dante. It's almost like the punishments, you know, that the sinners have to go through. You are doing something you're not supposed to do. And so for the longest time, I did not watch that part. So it was an imagined, I mean, I must have been 20 when I first saw the faces melt. And then I thought, geez, that's really funny. It looks like wax melting, and it probably was.
Exactly what it was, yeah.
But I didn't watch it. Like, he says, Marion, shut your eyes.
Yeah.
Tanya was shutting her eyes.
Well, you would not be sucked out of the Ark then, and you would have been just fine at the end of that movie. I mean, you've said a couple of things. One, like when all else fails, listen to Indiana Jones, because
yes,
he knows good stuff. That I remember seeing that as a kid, because that came out when I was about 7 or 8, and it was played nonstop on like TBS or whatever cable network we had access to. And I cannot think that I was ever scared of that, but I also, because I watched it so much as a wee little lad, that it never even worried me. There were parts of Temple of Doom think about Indiana Jones that was like, what are they doing to the monkey brains? Why are they eating the bugs?
Monkey brains?
Like all of that was like a bridge too far. So like eating a primate, I'm clearly not good with. But melting heads is just fine.
You have to know your line.
I will,
that's
and
it.
It's important to have that line.
Yes, yes, it is. The you know, see, that didn't bother, it didn't, I don't know why it didn't bother me to see somebody reach into somebody's chest to grab their heart and have it explode. Like, really? You know? That happens.
It did.
But the melting faces, that bothered me.
Well,
don't look at the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, you've recovered nicely, it seems, which I'm very proud of you.
Yes, I did.
Can I tell you an unrelated thing, though?
Sure.
I have two sons. They're 5 and 7. One is being Indiana Jones for Halloween. And my oldest is being a stormtrooper, and this makes me winning in the game of dad.
Oh, have they seen the original 3 Star Wars?
Of course they have.
Okay.
Have they seen them?
Because I know that this is like a, you know, there almost is a line between kids who know the first 3, and by first 3, I mean 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And those who can't watch those because they think that Jar Jar is the greatest thing since sliced bread, right?
Well, my kids have me as a dad, which means they have a very full understanding of what it means to be 4, 5, and 6, and that we tolerate 1, 2, and 3 only as a way to get to 7, 8, and 9. And so I'm okay with them. Like, I try not to get them into 1, 2, and 3, but when it's movie night and they pick it, I'm not angry, but I'm like, are you sure you don't want to watch, like, Empire? Like, because we really like Hoth. We like Hoth. And so if they pick 1 or 2 or 3, I'm okay, but I prefer 4, 5, 6.
Okay. Okay. Well, and that is that the first movie I actually remember seeing in a theater was Return of the Jedi.
Really? Me too. Yeah, yeah.
And it was such a big deal because they had an intermission. And like, you're sitting there and they stopped the movie. And because the movie was so long, and now when I watch it, I think it's not really long compared to like some Harry Potter stuff, you know, but they stopped it and they brought the little cart around and sold the popcorn and everything. It's like a real movie experience, right?
I don't remember the intermission in Raiders, but I do remember being really confused because I had not seen Empire Strikes Back yet. I didn't come from like a movie watching family in some ways. And so I knew I'd seen Star Wars because I knew who Luke was and who Han Solo was, but I had no idea why Han Solo had been turned into a coffee table. Because he wasn't a coffee table at the end of Star Wars. He was only a coffee table at the end of Empire. So I do felt confused, but I figured it out.
And we don't find that out until, like, you know, we have to go way back to find that out, right?
We do. And so I do remember feeling confusion, but I just thought Jabba the Hutt was pretty interesting. And
what do you think about the fact that they've redone and added, you know, like the CGI stuff now? Okay.
I know making faces at you is not good podcasting.
No, it's not.
You know, I guess it's George Lucas's thing, and I guess he gets to do with it what he wants. But when they release it on Blu-ray and they had the Ewoks blink, I never thought that the movie was better because of blinking Ewoks. You know, and like when they introduced the Jabba the Hutt scene and Han walks around him, and I was like, I didn't need that. So I guess I know people who are angry and they want to throw George Lucas out of a window for all that all those past sins. And I guess I let it go and just try to accept what I like.
Well, I watch old movies, older things, and I look at them and I think it's kind of like watching Indiana Jones. The effects in those movies are like, wow, we actually thought that they were awesome. Like, we thought that they were awesome.
We did,
you know?
But I also think, like the tradition that Lucas and Spielberg are working through on Indiana Jones is they're, like, riffing and playing off these 1950s kind of, like, movies. And so I think they went for the deliberately cartoony kind of effect. But, you know, I was watching because my kids also like Jurassic Park, and we watched Jurassic Park, which came out in 1993. And I'm not a math major, but that's 28 years ago. And you watch that movie, and it still looks great. Like, have you watched Jurassic Park recently?
No.
Oh, you should.
I don't think I've actually seen any Jurassic Park movies.
You've never seen Jurassic Park?
His face is really, no.
Also not good. Like, the face I'm making is also not good podcasting. You've never seen Jurassic Park?
No. No.
We have to work on this.
Not why?
Because it's marvelous. So the first film class I taught here was a class all on Spielberg. And so we kind of went in chronological order. So we started with Jaws. And it's not his first movie, but Jaws changed the movie world. And then we did Jaws. We did Indiana Jones. And we did Temple of Doom. I think we did. But we did Jurassic Park. And Jurassic Park sort of did for paleontology. Maybe what the Da Vinci Code did for art history. It's like I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was 7. I didn't know what archaeologists were. I just knew Indiana Jones was cool. And I think there's like a generation of people who wanted to be dinosaur people because of Jurassic Park. And it's this marvelous movie that really finds a way to make story and effects work together in a way that doesn't always. Like, I haven't seen most of the Avenger movies, and this might get me in trouble with the Avenger people in the world.
Now, see, I can't believe that.
Yeah.
That's what I can't believe.
Yeah. I think I'm just not a superhero dude, I guess, on some levels.
I'm not a dinosaur dude.
But I'm a good movie person. And maybe you're not a good movie person, which is I'll bring you a Blu-ray, and if you don't enjoy it, I will refund your money.
I don't know that I have the capacity to play a Blu-ray.
We can't be friends anymore.
I don't think I have the technology.
Maybe I have a DVD copy somewhere lying around for you.
I don't think I have that. I don't think I have a player.
I will give
you
$4 to stream it on Amazon.
No, it's okay.
But Jurassic Park is one of those movies that's really old, and you just watch it, and it holds up visually. It really does. But you wouldn't know. I could just tell you that they made it last year, and you wouldn't know.
No. Oh, okay. So you brought up Dan Brown.
I did. I'm
which
sorry.
Which is really funny because I am a big fan.
Yeah, he's marvelous.
Of the puzzle books.
Yeah, perfect.
Oh,
all right, let's go. I'm ready.
Oh, wow.
It's Dan Brown time.
Is that, is that how people have your job framed? Like, because I never have talked to you and thought, gee, he's like the Dan Brown guy.
No, but can I tell you a Dan Brown story?
Sure.
Okay, so when I was in graduate school, I worked at a Barnes & Noble in Bethesda, Maryland. And this is about the time when the Da Vinci Code came out. And Dan Brown came to the store that I worked at, and he signed books, and I got an autographed copy of the Da Vinci Code. I hadn't read his first two books. It's not necessarily my literary genre. Anyone who reads Dante, different translations of Dante for fun, doesn't like, ooh, Dan Brown. But I read this book, and I was working on the first floor, and a woman came up to me, and here I am, it was probably my second or third year as a PhD student, and she held up the Da Vinci Code, and she said, have you read this? And I looked at it, I said, I kind of giggled. I was like, I did, in fact, read that. And she said, what, you didn't believe it? I said, did I believe it? I was like, I think it's a work of fiction. But if you're asking about the supposition of the first page that says this is a work of fiction, but all descriptions of the art, architecture, and secret societies is true, you're asking me if I believe that. No, that's a blatant lie or a fictive fantasy. And she looked at me with like this glaring eyes and she said, you know what your problem is? And I was like, I don't, but I'm looking forward to it. She's like, you just don't know enough about the art. And then she stormed away. I was like, I don't, that's my big problem. Of all the problems I have, I don't know enough things about art.
She got you. She nailed you there.
I know.
Now, what I think, the value I see in Dan Brown's works is the same as the value I see in, like, National Treasure as a movie.
Sure. And I love National Treasure, so I can get it. Like, it's fun.
It is fun. And it is interesting to go, like, oh, my God, the Pope did it.
Yeah.
Oh, the Camerlingo did it.
I'd like to thank Dan Brown for this because he has given me endless opportunity to make fun of him in the classes I teach when I talk about the traditional depiction of St. John the Beloved, who is often shown with long flowing red hair and just slightly effeminate. And he's, you know, and Dan Brown's like, look, it's Mary Magdalene. And like, how do I know? Well, she has long hair. And then you look at Jesus also with long hair and you're like, doesn't quite work for me there, Dan. But I do appreciate the opportunity to talk about Dan Brown in class. And I will say this too. I mean, when that book came out, there was a spike in art history majors.
Your business.
I wonder what they're doing now. Yeah, they probably didn't finish.
So what would you be doing if you weren't a professor?
Could I be a DJ at a roller skating rink still?
Yeah, absolutely you could. I don't know. Are there roller skating rinks around?
I think there's one in New Orleans, but what would I, you know, I don't know. I mean, if art history is the thing I know most about, but I could see myself teaching a variety of things that intersect with it. I would love to be a literary critic, like writing about books. Anna once asked me, my wife asked me, she said, do you like, because I really enjoy study abroad and I really like setting up trips. And she said, would you ever, like, do you think you would ever like work as a travel agent? I said, well, no, because I like both setting up trips and going on them. And I think study or like travel agents only set up the trips. But if someone were to tell me that you could drop me in Florence and be a tour guide, for like Americans who are looking for like a cheeky and interesting exploration of the city, I think that would be a lot of fun. So yeah, I would say like I maybe be a literary critic or a tour guide.
Because there's lots of room for that, right?
Right. No kidding.
Okay. Well, Dr. Zygmunt Brian, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
I was delighted to talk about Indiana Jones and Dante.
We could work it all in.
Awesome.
I guess this is what your class is like, right?
Terrifyingly so, perhaps, at times.
Awesome. That's awesome. Well, thanks, y'all, for joining us today on Beyond 1894. Look up Dr. Zygmunt if you have any interest in studying abroad.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Beyond 1894. Please subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about this episode, check out our show notes. Beyond 1894 is produced by Louisiana Tech University's Office of University Communications.